I thank you for that, Daryl. Some of you that have been around for a long time, you remember when Daryl's voice was stronger than it is now. But I'm going to tell you something, his heart's never been any more pure than it is now. Daryl has always walked with the Lord from the time that I first met him. I have never doubted his walk with God. There are times when you know that he's just thinking about how can I make the Lord look good. And I'm telling you, he just keeps wanting to serve the Lord. And I thank him for singing tonight. And I thank him for his heart. Well, let's turn in our Bibles to 2 Samuel chapter 6. 2 Samuel 6. Tonight, the title of the message is David's Worship and Michal's Worldliness. David's Worship and Michal's Worldliness. The last time I preached out of this passage, a couple of weeks ago, David was leading a procession into Jerusalem. They had gone and they had retrieved the Ark of the Covenant from a man's house. And it was a house that was blessed of God. The man's name was Obed-Edom. The reason that it had been housed there is because 3 months earlier, they were trying to bring that Ark into Jerusalem on a cart. I don't know why they chose the cart. I know that's the way that the Philistines had tried to carry it back when it was causing all types of problems for them whenever they tried to put it in the house of Dagon, their fish god. And so a man named Uzzah reached out when it shook. He touched it and God smote him. He killed him. And some people think that God was being harsh with that, but God has certain ways that he wants things done. He told Moses way back 400 years prior to this time how to carry that ark. And the Levites were supposed to take poles, run it through the rings on the side, and carry it on their shoulders. And so when Uzzah was killed, David put that ark in Obed-Edom's house. His house was blessed, and 3 months later, everything that Obed-Edom had was just multiplied. And so David said, okay, we will now take it from Obed-Edom's house, and we will take it to Jerusalem. And he did it the right way. He had the Levites put it on the poles. They carried it, and as they were going into Jerusalem, that's where we left off the last time. And so tonight, we come to verse 16. We will finish the chapter this evening. And verse 16 begins with a blessing. So I want you to notice the blessings that are in our first part tonight. We're going to come back to verse 16 later, but we'll go ahead and read it at the beginning. And as the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, Michal, Saul's daughter, looked through a window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord. And she despised him in her heart. Keep that in mind. And they brought in the ark of the Lord and set it in his place in the midst of the tabernacle that David had pitched for it. Now you remember that a tabernacle is a tent. It is a temporary structure. The Old Testament saints that came out of Egypt, they were to construct the tabernacle. I do not know if this was the same tabernacle or not, but I do know that it was a tabernacle that was dedicated simply to house the Ark of the Covenant. And so David had pitched this tent. He had set up this tent specifically for this ark. And notice what David's behavior is. he begins to offer burnt offerings. Now, they've been doing this regularly. From the time that they left Obed-Edom's house, about every 6 paces or about every 27 to 30 feet, they would stop and they would have a celebration and they'd have a sacrifice. They'd go another 30 feet and do the same thing. And now they have finally reached Jerusalem and they are placing the ark into its own place, its own tent. And then David begins offering these burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. We will not get into the burnt offerings and the peace offerings this evening. I just want you to see that he is worshiping God at the place that has now been assigned for worship. Can I tell you that God has always had a place to worship? There's always been a place where God wanted his people to go and worship collectively. In this particular location here, this was people that had come to the city of David, we know as Jerusalem. They have come from far and wide. They've come from the Galilee in the north, and they've come from the Negev in the south, and they are now here, and they are worshiping. They've been a part of the procession, and they are giving it everything that they've got. And David is leading the way. And so, the first thing that I want you to notice is found in the latter part of verse 18. This is after the worship is over. The celebrations have finally come to an end. And so what does David do? Well, if you look at verse 18, the latter part of it, it says, "He, David, blessed the people in the name of the Lord of hosts." In other words, he prayed a blessing on these people that had come from all over the country to be a part of this celebration. And so as he prays for them, I think that that is something that you and I can learn from, that we ought to be making intercession for each other. Whenever we come to church and we find out about each other and we worship together and we just fellowship, and all of a sudden we find out that Sister So-and-so's got a test coming up, and Brother So-and-so, he's lost a brother in another city. And it's like, we're just going to pray and intercede on their behalf and ask God's blessing on them. And that's what David does. He is asking God to bless the people. And so they are receiving a blessing before they leave to go back to their homes, whether it's up north or down south. And so, what does he do for them? Well, after the worship is over, they have a time when they're going to receive gifts from the king. Now, preparation has gone into this. You don't just have something like this happen when you're talking about thousands of people. But I want you to see what David has prepared for these folks. "And he dealt among all the people, even among the whole multitude of Israel." In other words, it wasn't just the leaders of the tribes. It was everybody. I want you to notice this, and you ladies ought to like this, all right? Look with me when it says, "When he dealt with the whole multitude of Israel, as well to the women as men." In other words, every person that was in the congregation, the whole multitude, not just the men, but the women and the men, were going to receive these gifts from the Lord. I hear people on a regular basis, whether it be on a talk show or reading some type of article, and they begin to denigrate the Bible and they say, "Oh, the Bible is one of those books that just puts women down." Can I tell you that the Bible and Christianity is what liberated women? Before Christianity, women were basically treated like cattle. Years ago, I went to college with a man named Fred Willis. And old Fred was a pastor for many, many years in Hilton Head, Georgia, or South Carolina, just across the Georgia line. Well, Fred went to the Holy Land on a trip. And his wife was a very attractive lady. He was an older guy. Fred's probably 10 years older than I am. And at the time, he would have probably been in his early to mid 30s, and his wife would have probably been in her early 30s. And so they're over in I guess it was probably the Jordan area. And all of a sudden, an Arab man comes up to him. And he looks at him and he goes, "How much for the woman?" And Fred said, "Excuse me?" And the Arab guy goes, "How much for the woman?" And he goes, "You talking about my wife?" "Yeah, how much for the woman?" And he goes, "Well, my wife's not for sale." And the guy thought he was dickering with him. He said, "20 camels. I'll give you 20 camels for the woman." And he goes, "No." He goes, "30 camels. 30 camels for the woman." And finally, Fred got it across to him, "She's not for sale. She's my wife." But that's the way that they treated women in the Middle East. Can I tell you that even in Israel today, when you go to the Western Wall, some people call it the Wailing Wall, there's two sides to it. The largest side is where the men go. But then there's a partition, and over here on this side is where the ladies go. And so when you began to look at the old time religions, women did not have a specific place. But when the New Testament came along, all of a sudden, according to Galatians chapter 3, in Christ there is neither male nor female. There's neither Jew nor Gentile. There's neither bond nor free. In other words, everybody's equal at Calvary. And so here David, way back, going against the culture of his day, he treats the ladies the same way that he treats the men as far as the gifts. Can I tell you, I think that's wonderful. I think that he was a wise man in valuing their position, because the position that they had in society was not always elevated. And so you've got David, and he takes the women and he treats them the same way as the men are treated when it comes to the gifts. Now, what does he give them? Well, the first thing that he does, he gives them a cake of bread. In other words, they have a loaf of bread that they can wrap up in some type of cloth. They can put that in some type of carrying bag. And as they're walking back to wherever their home is at, they can take that out and they can have that bread cake and they can eat a little bit to sustain them on their journey. Now, I know one of the ways that they cook in Israel is they do raisin cakes. Perhaps this had to do with some type of bread that maybe had some kind of flavoring in it. But I do know that it was at least a bread, and breads are a big deal in the Middle East. It's part of the Mediterranean diet. And so when David has all of these loaves of bread, I mean by the thousands that have been cooked, he's giving all of them a cake of bread. Not only that, what else does he give them? He gives them a good piece of flesh. That means it was a good size piece. He gave them a nice piece of lamb, goat, some type of animal that had been probably roasted so that could go with the bread. Now, I want to tell you something. It's tough to beat a sandwich that's got good bread and good meat. And that is exactly what he does for them. But then he also gives them a flagon, which is basically, it was a skin of wine. And so the people departed, everyone to his house. Now I want you to think about the thinking of the people as they leave Jerusalem. They have been excited. They have lined the streets as the Ark of God comes into town. They are as happy as they can be. There's joy in Jerusalem. They see their king, and he is worshiping God. He's dancing in the street, and he is excited. And so there is a blessing that they're receiving, knowing that this is a different time in our nation. You never find Saul doing anything like David does. And can I tell you that David does things, especially early in his ministry, that makes people know he's different. And so as they're going back, they're thinking, man, this bread is some good bread. He didn't give us some old stale bread. This is good bread. Man, look at this piece of meat we got. I mean, he has given us a good, goodly piece. I mean, we may not even be able to eat this by the time we get home. And I mean, if we get thirsty, we don't have to find some creek bed somewhere, some little wadi that might have a little bit of water in it. No, we've got our own little flask that he's given to us, and we're able to quench our thirst. And so they're talking about this stuff. They're not worried about stopping at McDonald's down the road. You know what they're doing? They're just loving their life because they've got a king that loves God. When the leaders love God, the people are blessed. And so we see that there's the blessings that are there. But then there's a second thing that happens. He is wanting to have something good happen, not just with the people. He's wanting his own home to be blessed. Look with me at our passage of scripture at verse 20 and the first part of it, the first little sentence. Then David returned to bless his household. Do you know that a man ought to want his house to be blessed of God? David was happy to bless other people, but he also wanted those that lived in his house to be blessed. And so we see he's trying to bless everybody. But the second thing that I want you to notice is I want you to notice a berating. The proverb says this. It says, it's better to dwell in the corner of a housetop than with a brawling woman. All right? Now, I want that to soak in. All right? It's better to dwell in an attic in a corner than it is with a woman that just won't get off your back. Dr. Hudson used to say this. I remember this from my college days, pre-married days. He said, ladies, if you'll do four things, you couldn't run your husband off with a shotgun. Number one, cook good meals. If you cook good meals, you're going to keep him happy. You've all heard the old adage, the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. All right? Men like good food. Number two, keep a clean house. In other words, make it nice, make it clean. You don't want rats and bugs and everything else crawling all over the place. Now there's dirt and there's dirty dirt. Dirt is when maybe one of the kids have drug something out of the toy chest. Dirty dirt's when it's there 6 weeks later. All right? Number three, give him plenty of love and affection. And number four, don't nag. If you'll do those four things, you won't be able to run him off with a gun. And so, we have a berating that takes place. Look at verse 16. That's the verse I wanted you to go back to. All right? And the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, Michal, Saul's daughter, looked through a window. Why was she not down on the streets worshiping? Why was she not a part of the worship? No. She's too good to get in there with the riffraff. So she's looking out a window, and what does she see? She sees King David leaping and dancing before the Lord. And then notice the next little phrase. She despised him in her heart. Now, I want you to go back in her history. She's probably somewhere in her 30s now, early 30s. You see, David was on the run for probably 15 years, if not longer. They married a long time ago, and when David finally had to go as a fugitive, King Saul took his youngest daughter, Michal, and gave her to another man to be his wife. But when David became king, he reclaimed his wife and brought her into his home. Something happened in her life between those early years and now. What was it? I don't know. I know this. I know that early on, she was not a spiritual girl. And the reason that I know that is because we won't go to it tonight, but if you would go back to 1 Samuel 19, back when she and David first married, one of the things that you will find is that in her home, she had a teraphim, which is an idol. And so she was never a spiritual young lady. At the early years, she did love David. And I guess if we were going to say one thing that was good about her tonight, we could say that she was a young lady that always had courage. We ought to always try to look for something good in the life of people, and I could say that she had courage. You say, well, why do you say that? Well, do you remember when Saul was trying to kill David, and he sent those guys, a pack of them, one night to his home? And she made like that his body was in the bed, and they're over there with their spears and their swords, and they're stabbing it, and she's already let him down a window. She defied her father, and so therefore her father could have disciplined her, or he could have executed her, and so she had courage to stand up for David. Now you fast forward here, and what does she do? She's rebuking the new king, which is her husband, at a time when that could cost somebody their life. And so I guess if we were going to say a good thing about her, we could say that she was a woman of courage. But here you've got David leaping, dancing before the Lord, but in her heart, she's hating him. I don't know if she was ticked that he took her from her second husband and brought her back into his home. I don't know, but I know this. I know that the scriptures tell us that she despised him in her heart. Not only that, look at the latter part of verse 20. She came out to meet David. In other words, she's been up in a window, she's watching him, and now she knows that he's coming home, and so she meets him at the front door. That's not always good. She meets him at the front door, and she begins to, in a way that is almost mocking. How glorious was the king of Israel today, who uncovered himself today in the eyes of the handmaids of his servants. In other words, you basically undressed in front of a bunch of slave girls. As one of the vain fellows shamelessly uncovereth himself. In other words, you had certain vain men, just everyday drunks, everyday men that did not care about morality, and they wandered the streets, And they would dress any way that they wanted to dress. They would act the way that they wanted to act. And here she is accusing the king. She's accusing her husband of acting like these empty, vain men. That's a horrible thing for a woman to do after she has seen her husband trying to worship God. I'm telling you right now that it's a sad thing for a man to love God, go to church, try to love the Lord, and go home and have to fight with a woman that questions his every motive. I mean, some of the most heartbroken men that I have ever talked to were men that loved the Lord, and they had to fight tooth and nail when they got home. And so you've got this woman, and she is mocking him. And can I tell you, first of all, the criticism that she gave is untrue? David is not naked. He's not there in a loincloth with his shirt off. The only thing he has off is his royal robe. If we were to look at another passage of scripture over in Chronicles, in Chronicles 15, we would see that David was wearing a linen ephod. In other words, he had taken off his royal robe. He had humbled himself just like an average priest would. He had put on just a nice white shirt, some type of woven fabric that had probably been bleached, and it was white. It was just simple. There was nothing royal about it. There was nothing exuberant about it. It was just plain, but he was just dancing before the Lord as just one of the people. And so the criticism that she said, you're embarrassing yourself, you're dancing naked before, you know, these people, that was not true. And so we see that she was being dishonest. Can I tell you, second of all, that she was ungrateful? Do you know if David had not taken her back into his home, that she would have lived her life in obscurity? Someone who had been born into royalty, someone who had lived in Saul's house, she had been used to people taking care of her. She had all kind of probably handmaids that would help her with anything she needed help with. And yet here she was pawned off to another man. And David takes her and brings her back as his rightful husband, or her rightful husband. And so, she's ungrateful. Not only that, I believe that her words revealed a wickedness in her heart. How can you despise a person in your heart and that not come out with an ugliness? When people begin to speak, you need to listen really closely, because ultimately the words that come out reveal the heart. That's what Jesus said. And so we see that there's a wickedness in her soul. There's a third thing that I want you to see, and I want you to see the blowback. You say, what do you mean by that, Brother Tom? What I mean by that is this: David doesn't tolerate it. Look with me at verse 21. And David said unto Michal, it was before the Lord which chose me before thy father and before all of his house to appoint me ruler over the people of the Lord over Israel. Therefore will I play before the Lord. In other words, he's telling her, I don't care what you say. Let me tell you why I'm doing this. I wasn't doing this for you. I wasn't doing this for the people. I was doing this for Jehovah. And can I tell you, that's the only person that we need to please is God. I had somebody one time, there was a problem going on. I had somebody ask me, they said, well, are you on this side or are you on that side? I said, I'm on neither side. I'm on Jesus' side. We're going to do what the Bible has to say, regardless of who's on what side. That's the place that you go to, as you go to the side that the Bible is on. And so You need to remember that when you're trying to make a decision. And so, you've got David, and he says, I was doing this before God. Can I tell you that if somebody criticizes you and your heart is pure and you are doing this before the Lord, as long as it's biblical, don't worry about the criticism. You just say, this is what I'm doing for God. Now, if somebody can show you in the Bible where you have strayed biblically, that's a whole different can of worms right there. But if you are biblical and you're serving God, then don't worry about the rest of it. Because ultimately, you're going to be at the judgment seat of Christ, not the judgment seat of fill in the blank. It's the judgment seat of the Lord is who we've got to worry about. And I'm going to tell you something. When I stand there, I'm not going to be worried about you. I'm going to have all I can take care of just taking care of me. And so you've got blowback. And he said, I was doing this before the Lord. Not only that, he said, God chose me over your father and over his house. He might have even said something like this, and this is simply reading between the lines. He said, you remember your brother Jonathan, the one that was close to me? Even Jonathan knew that God chose me over him. He told me that you will be the king over Israel, and I will be your vice regent. I'll be your assistant. Because I know that God has put his hand on you. Jonathan told me that. You know, the one that didn't understand that was Ishbosheth. And Ishbosheth was the one boy that did not die over on Mount Gilboa. Ishbosheth got set up by Abner to be the king. He was Abner's little stooge. And the next thing you know, he was murdered. God put me, not your father, not your brothers, he put me as the king of Israel. And he said, not only that, but I was put to be the ruler over not just Judah, but all of Israel. And so we see that it was the Lord that chose him. Now, there's a determination that we see in David. It's not a surprise. I mean, we see determination in David constantly. I mean, he could have cowered in fear when he was just a teenage boy, when he was out there on the side of that mountain, and he hears that huge 9.5 foot tall man basically blaspheming God. He could have cowered as a little boy, but he didn't. He was determined if it cost him his life, he was going to do something, and God gave him a victory over Goliath. He was determined to not die as he's on the run from Saul after one attempt after another on his life. And he is constantly surviving. Why? Because of sheer determination, knowing that he is on the right side. And so you've got a contrast between these two people. Now, what's the contrast? She's sitting up in a window. She sees him dancing in an ephah linen. She accuses him of being naked. She accuses him of basically being just a nobody because he's hanging out with the common people. Can I tell you, I would rather hang out with the common people than with the upper crust? Because the upper crust, they have a tendency to think of themselves in a better way. One person said many years ago, said the upper crust, that's where a few crumbs got together on top. The common people have always been drawn to Jesus. What was the criticism of Jesus? Well, whenever he goes around, he eats with publicans and sinners. He's the one that elevated people like the Samaritan woman that had been married 5 times and living with a 6th man. He's the one that elevated the woman and kept her from being stoned to death in John chapter 8, which is what that song was about tonight. You've got Jesus constantly hanging out with people that are in the lower rungs of society. And here we see David, and he's hanging out with the common folks as they are just worshiping God, and they're happy that the Ark of God is now in Jerusalem. And so there's a huge, huge contrast in those two. I really believe this, that we ought to be excited as David was about our service to the Lord. There's a man named W.G. Blakey. He's a commentator, and he made this statement. He said, "There are doubtless times to be calm," talking about in worship service, "and there are times to be enthusiastic. But can it be right to give all of our coldness to Christ and all of our enthusiasm to the world?" You think about that. You'll have people that'll go to a Georgia game, and they will scream and holler until they are hoarse, and they can't even answer their cell phone, which causes them to get into a panic the next day. Because, you know, everybody is on a cell phone nowadays. I went to a doctor's office not long ago. I was sitting there, and there was 14 people. I counted 14 people in that office. And all 14 of them, including me, had their cell phones out, and they were just looking at their cell phones. Checking email, sending text messages, reading the internet. And I made the statement, I said, "You know, this is nuts." These people are like, "Who are you?" I said, "We got 14 people in this waiting room right here, and none of us are talking to each other. We're all looking at our cell phones." You know what they did? Started looking at their cell phone again. We have people, and they will hoop and they will holler at a ball game. When church is over tonight, you know what I'll do? I'll find out, you know, who's going to win who's won the game, or if it's still going on. I'll find out who won the Braves and the Cardinals tonight. I'll find that out. And I hope the Braves win. I'll find out if the Cowboys got beat again. I'll find that out. But I'm going to tell you something. I ought to be more excited about God than I am any team. I ought to be more excited about the Lord than I am anything that the world's got to offer. And there ought to be more enthusiasm for the things of God. And if there's any coldness, let's give it to something besides the Lord Jesus. And so we see that he is committed. He is enthusiastic, unlike Mikal. He also makes a prediction. And this is a fun prediction for me. I want you to look at verse 22. And what does she accuse him of? "You have uncovered yourself in the eyes of the handmaids," according to the middle of verse 20. But then in verse 22, he said this, "And I will yet be more vile." If you think that was wrong, he said, "I will yet be more vile than thus, and will be base in mine own sight. And of the handmaid servants, which thou hast spoken of them shall I be had in honor." You know all of those girls that you are denigrating? The ones that were out there and they were happy that the ark of God was coming to the city of Jerusalem. Those that were happy that you're talking down to. Let me tell you something. I'm going to double my efforts, and they're going to like me even more. And that's his prediction. And can I tell you that prediction came true? It did come true. In Israel today, if you ask the average person on the street who's the greatest king that Israel ever had, bar none, it's David. He started out his reign by doing things that just endeared him to the nation of Israel. His heart was a good heart. He had a Daryl heart, all right? He had a good heart, and the people responded to that. But let me give you one final thought tonight, and that's found in verse 23. There's a barrenness. Verse 23. After he came back, and after he basically, he told her, he said, "I don't care what you say, I'm going to double down on it. This was the result of her getting on his last good nerve for the last time. Therefore, Michal, the daughter of Saul. You know, it seems as though that the writer of Samuel wanted us to really get this nailed down, because three times he uses that term, Michal, the daughter of Saul. It's as though he's drawn a distinction between the house of Saul and the house of David. One is all about the exterior, all about what happens outwardly. But this one is about what happens inwardly. You've got Saul, which was totally different in the way that he conducted things and the way that David did. You have David, and after all of the worship and the festivities are over, he gives people a piece of meat, he gives them a cake of bread, he gives them a flask of wine, and so they're leaving, they're happy. And you take an instance like Saul, and he almost starves his troops to death when he said, I don't want anybody to eat anything during this day. And his own boy, Jonathan, after the battle, takes the tip of his spear, puts it in a honeycomb, touches it to his mouth, and eats it. And people go, wait a minute, don't do that. Well, it was too late. He'd already done it. And what did Saul do? He said, I will kill Jonathan for disobeying. Jonathan didn't even know about it. And had it not been for the people, Saul would have killed his own boy. And so you've got David, and he's totally different than Saul. And so now you've got Michal, the daughter of Saul. And what does it say? She had no child until the day of her death. Now, there's two ways to look at that. The first way that people would look at that is they would say, well, that meant that whenever she and David had their intimate relationship as husband and wife, that God just did not open her womb and her become pregnant. The second way that people look at that, and this is the way that I think it was, I think that because she so despised David that he came to the point to where he despised her, and I don't think they ever had intimate relations as husbands and wife. She lived in her part of the house. He lived in his part of the house. And they never were together in a biblical way of knowing one another intimately. And she never had a child until the day that she died. And so, you have the story of David bringing the ark into the city of Jerusalem. It has its own place. David starts things in a great way. I mean, when he is first approached, he begins to bring all the people together. Then he says, we need a city, and he takes the city of Jabus from the Jebusites. They go up through the water shaft, and he begins to think, we need to bring the ark of God so that this will be the central place of worship. He gets all of that finally done after chapter 6. And now when we get to chapter 7 the next time, what are we going to see? We're going to see David sitting around, and he's thinking, God needs his own house. Other people have a house, but the ark of God's dwelling in a tent. Lord, what about a house? And that's what we'll get to the next time. Let's stand together.